just remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Good morning, Vietnam, and good timely greeting to you, dear listener. Welcome back to this super special Thanksgiving installment here at Play It Again, Kyla. I am so excited for the film that we're going to discuss today. I know I say that every episode, and I truly mean it every episode, but I especially mean it here today because the movie that we're going to be talking about is one of my favorite holiday movies of all time, and it is definitively my favorite Thanksgiving movie of all time. And I've been telling everyone for the past couple of weeks that I was going to be doing this episode for Thanksgiving, and invariably the response I've gotten from people is, what's Pieces of April? What's a Thanksgiving movie? I didn't know they made Thanksgiving movies. So the two Thanksgiving movies, in my opinion, that everyone should be aware of are Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and Pieces of April. And out of the two, I actually prefer Pieces of April. It's the best Thanksgiving movie of all time. And so if you haven't seen it, I can't recommend it highly enough. I hope that you'll watch it before listening to the entirety of this episode because there's going to be some spoilers and things, but I hope that you'll go watch it and I hope you'll listen to this episode. I'm really excited for the conversation that's going to be had. This is a really great mother-daughter film, so I'm going to be discussing it with my mother. So I hope that you are all ready to jump in and hear about the greatest Thanksgiving film of all time, Pieces of April. Let's go ahead and dive on in, shall we?
Completely selfish of her, asking us to come all the way to New York.
Some families do whatever it takes to remain close.
They're probably not even going to come.
Okay, everybody, let's move it!
And then there are families who know better.
We must have a special relationship.
We're very close.
We're going to have a very nice time.
You don't actually believe that.
It's possible, I think, yes.
You don't get along, do you?
Not at all, never have.
For days, I've been trying to think of nice April memories, and I can only come up with one.
She was just gazing out the window. And she said, oh, Mother, don't you just love every day?
That was me.
No! No!
I think Wayne. Wayne with the new stove.
What makes her think she can cook all of a sudden? I don't remember her ever being in the kitchen.
She's met this new guy.
Bobby!
Apparently, this guy, Bobby, reminds her of me.
Of April.
Welcome to Krispy Kreme. May I take your order?
Just remember, everybody, April was cooking.
We'll need an extra dozen glaze.
So here today to help me discuss the definitive Thanksgiving film and what I think is one of the definitive mother-daughter films is a special guest, my mother, Miss Denise Percival. Introduce yourself, Niecy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Niecy, Denise, Kyla's mom, and it's wonderful to be able to share with Kyla and with you all with this Thanksgiving special. Since Kyla is away from me, she's in Georgia and I'm in Pennsylvania. This is just one way that we're being brought together this Thanksgiving is by doing this. So thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, you stole what I was about to say, which was that this is actually, you and I are sharing Thanksgiving by sharing Pieces of April because we're not getting to be physically present with one another on Thanksgiving. So that's one reason I really wanted to do this episode is because I wanted to be able to share a Thanksgiving-related conversation and experience with you, Niecy.
Well, thank you, boo. That's special.
You're welcome. So since we're talking about Thanksgiving, and since you have answered every possible iteration of my standard getting to know you questions, so I'm not going to make you rehash any of those. You've answered my first set, my secondary set, my Natalie Portman set, all of my special series you have been a part of.
And so rather than giving you five getting to know you questions related to Thanksgiving or pieces of April or anything like that, I was just going to ask you this one simple question so that people at home that maybe haven't heard any of your previous episodes can feel like they get a sense for who you are as a moviegoer. And that one question is, what's your favorite piece of Thanksgiving related media?
I would have to say that my favorite piece of Thanksgiving related media is, surprisingly, it's something that you introduced me to, but it is the episode of Friends where she sticks her head in the turkey.
That's your favorite piece of Thanksgiving media? Yeah. The one with all the Thanksgiving.
It's the most memorable. You know, it painted that picture in my head. You know, that's something you just can't escape. So I would say that's it.
Yeah. Monica with her head in the turkey. And Joey with his head in the turkey.
Head in the turkey, too.
Also in that episode. Uh-huh. I think that Friends pretty much corners the market on best Thanksgiving-related media, which is something I wanted us to talk about later in the episode and we'll get into in just a little bit, is I think that television shows put out the best Thanksgiving-related media typically. Like, television shows usually have really good Thanksgiving episodes, and then there's not really that many Thanksgiving movies, which is interesting to me that television kind of corners the market on Thanksgiving. So Pieces of April is my favorite Thanksgiving. It's my favorite Thanksgiving related media on the whole, I think. But since you brought up Friends, I have to mention my favorite piece of Thanksgiving related media that comes from Friends is the one with all the football. When they all play football, they're competing for the Geller Cup. I like that one because it's set outside, which is so rare for a Friends episode. And so you actually get to see the foliage and everything. And they're all dressed like in wintry clothes and everything. And it has a very autumnal aesthetic. So I really like that. And then Pieces of April, of course. And then Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is another piece of Thanksgiving related media that I feel like bears mentioning.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that one.
Mm-hmm. And then another show that does Thanksgiving episodes really well, even though there's not a Thanksgiving episode every season of the show like there is with Friends, but Dawson's Creek does really good Thanksgiving episodes.
I figured you were going to bring up Dawson's Creek.
Yeah, so. It only took 4 minutes because we have to talk about Dawson's Creek in order to talk about this film. So that was a not at all subtle little segue into Pieces of April from television media to Pieces of April. So I want to invite you to talk about your experience with this film, and then I'll share a little bit about my experience, and that will definitely bring us back to Dawson's Creek when I share my experience. But when was the first time you saw this movie, Niecy? Can you remember what that experience was like, and how many times have you seen it since?
Let's see. I have seen this movie 3 times. Viewing it for this was my 3rd time. The first time I saw it, of course, not surprisingly, you introduced me to it. It was something that you really wanted us to watch as a family. And I remember at first, when it first started, I was kind of like, oh, I don't know that I'm going to like this. And it was more to do with the way it was shot, which turned out to be one of my favorite things. But anyway, I remember watching it and being stunned in places and laughing in places and then almost crying in places. And then when it was over, it was one of those things that I was so thankful that you said, let's do this together.
Mm-hmm. So both times prior to watching it for this episode, we watched it together, correct?
That's right. I've always watched it with you.
So my experience with this movie, if you've listened to this podcast for more than an episode or two, you've probably heard me mention Dawson's Creek because I just find a way. Everything is related to the creek in my brain. And Dawson's Creek became, I called it my favorite television show, from the time I was about, I would say 11. You think that's about right, Niecy?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, it was whenever I got my first iPod Touch. And I know that because there were really poor quality, screen recordings of Dawson's Creek episodes cut up into parts on YouTube. And that's how I first encountered Dawson's Creek. But my introduction to Dawson's Creek came directly from Katie Holmes, because I really liked the movie First Daughter. And I had watched First Daughter, and I was a big movie nerd, and I loved commentaries. And so I listened to the commentary on First Daughter. And in the scene where Katie Holmes' character and James, the Secret Service agent slash RA, kiss for the first time, in the commentary, one of her co-stars was like, "Oh, Katie, was this your first kiss?" And she was like, "Haha, no, I have to kiss people all the time on Dawson's Creek." And I was like, "What's Dawson's Creek?" And so I Googled it, because I liked Katie Holmes, and I'm a sucker for like small town, friendship based, sprawling romantic arc shows. So it was like the perfect show for me, you know. And so I started watching it when I got my iPod Touch for Christmas and could look it up on YouTube. And so I loved Dawson's Creek. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm a pretty big Katie Holmes fan now. Let's see what else she's been in. And so I think I was 12 or 13 when I found Pieces of April. And I really enjoyed it and decided that I was going to start watching it every Thanksgiving. And so I've tried to keep that tradition. There have been a couple years where I've missed it for whatever reason. But I would say on the whole, I've probably seen it 10 times. Uh-huh. So that would be about right if I saw it at 12 for the first time. But I really, really love this film. This is the movie that I point to when people want to denigrate Katie Holmes as an actress. I'm like, okay, but have you seen Pieces of April? You know? Because that's an easier sell than have you seen all 128 episodes of Dawson's Creek?
Exactly.
So they're not going to watch every episode to see that the girl who plays Joey Potter is a great actress, but they might make it through the 1 hour and 20 minute film, you know?
And it is a short film.
It is. It's very short, which I think is part of its strength. Like, it doesn't overstay its welcome at all. And also, I think part of the strength of it being so short also is that this film is classified as a race against time. Like, that's the central theme that Peter Hedges, like, that's when asked what the theme of this movie is, he says, you know, it's a race against time.
Exactly.
And so if it were any longer, I feel like it would just be too much, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to be racing towards a definitive endpoint that we actually reach, and like an hour and a half is a pretty believable amount of time for us to like sit with that race, you know. But if it extended beyond that time frame, it might just feel like too much at that point.
Right.
That was a very delayed right, but it's okay.
I'm sorry.
it's okay. We're racing against time here, Niecy, you and I.
Okay.
So before I start giving you my standard questions that I give once we dive into what I like to call the nitty gritty of our discussion, I want to do as I always do and offer some behind the scenes fun facts about the making of this movie. The first of which is that this is director Peter Hedges' directorial debut. Hedges was a somewhat successful novelist and screenwriter prior to Pieces of April, and Pieces of April was actually his first project that he wrote as a screenplay. Everything else he had written as a novel and then adapted it for the screen. But his most successful work prior to Pieces of April was actually What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which was the film that launched the career of Leonardo DiCaprio.
Wow.
And what's really interesting about that, what I really like about that fact, is that Derek Luke, the actor who plays Bobby in this film, was actually the last actor to audition for the part of Bobby. He like auditioned right before production began, and Peter Hedges hired him on the spot because he said that it was the best audition he had ever seen since Leonardo DiCaprio.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's neat.
So I thought that was interesting. Also, Cisco, who plays Latrell, wanted to play the part of Bobby. I don't know if you realize that Latrell was played by Sisko, the man who sings Thong Song. But yes, this is one of the same. That. but he had reached out because he wanted to play the part of Bobby, and Peter Hedges had to tell him no because he's shorter than Katie Holmes. Isn't that hilarious?
Katie Holmes is tall, yes.
Yeah, Katie Holmes is pretty tall. She's pretty tall. So one of the facts that I find most interesting about the making of this movie is that Peter Hedges actually began work on this project almost a decade before it was actually produced. And so he started writing like the basics of this script, and he knew that it was going to be about, you know, a mother who was going through cancer and her estranged daughter trying to have Thanksgiving. And it was somewhat, it was based on a story that his group of friends had where they borrowed like a neighboring apartment, like they commandeered a neighboring apartment so that they could make Thanksgiving dinner. But he had shelved it, like he wasn't actively working on it. And then his mother was diagnosed with cancer. And as his mother was going through cancer treatments, she encouraged him to continue pursuing his writing career. And so he went back through all his old drafts. And as he was doing that, he remembered that he had begun a draft about a mother going through cancer treatments. And so he pulled out pieces of April and told his mother about it. And she said that he needed to see it through. And so after his mother passed away, he completed the script.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? That's like, this is a little random, but it reminds me of, I hope that other people see the comparison in these two stories, but it reminds me of the fun fact about The Little Mermaid, which was that, like Walt Disney had begun an outline and like a draft of a script that was very similar to the plot of The Little Mermaid. And then, like, obviously Walt Disney passed away, and people who worked for the Disney Corporation years later began writing The Little Mermaid. And before they completed the script, they found an old safe of Walt Disney's and cracked it open. And in it, they found the drafts of The Little Mermaid. And so it's just like, there's something about like, there's something to me about these projects that it's just like, they were just meant to be made, you know, like the stars aligned and brought the creative people back to the point where they were meant to complete that story, you know?
Exactly.
And so Peter Hedges says that this film isn't necessarily autobiographical, but it was definitely impacted by his mother's experience and death, and that he wanted to make a movie not about his mother, but as a tribute to her. So
I could see this being that.
Katie Holmes was always attached to this project as the lead role. She was always going to play April. And she was drawn to the part because it was different from anything else that she had ever done professionally. And Oliver Platt and Patricia Clarkson agreed very early on to do the film. And when they agreed, it was in pre-production with a budget of $7 million. And this movie did not actually end up having a budget that was $7 million. It ended up having a budget that was $300,000. And so, with that budget, the cast and crew were paid. The cast was paid $200 a day, the crew $100 a day, and Peter Hedges was paid $20 to both write and direct the film.
You are kidding me.
And it was shot in 16 days. Very, very tight shooting schedule. A lot of the locations, like the location used for the family's house, the Salvation Army store, those were only available for single days. And so due to time constrictions, some of the shots of them driving are actually, like, they're actually driving between locations. Like, they're on the road because they don't have any extra time. So they're shooting the scenes in the car as they drive from two shooting locations.
So the filming of this was really a race against time.
Yes, truly, truly a race against time. I love stories about movies where it's like, okay, we have this much money, we have this much time, let's get it done. You know, that's Garden State, $2 million in a month. Let's do it. Pieces of April, $300,000, 16 days. Let's do it. And usually those movies end up being my, like, my very favorites. You know, like, the quality stands the test of time, even though it's not a ton of money that's pumped into these projects, you know?
Right.
So some residents of the apartment building that was used were extras in the film. And it was very challenging filming in those interior spaces of the apartment because it was really small. This movie was shot digitally and with handheld cameras, which were almost exclusively used for close and medium shots because resolution in wide shots was very low at the time. And you can tell that because there's one wide shot that immediately comes to mind when I think of this movie, and it's that wide shot where you see, like, the whole view of the street and April standing alone out front of the apartment. And that's a very low resolution shot. And so you can see why they didn't rely on a lot of wide shots. Even though that shot is very striking, I think it's made all the more striking because wide shots are used so sparingly throughout the film, you know? Because that's kind of the first time we see anyone in wide shot, and it makes her look small.
Right, it does.
Yeah. So most scenes also were shot with two cameras rolling simultaneously, so that they could be filmed in one take. Many, many of these scenes were filmed in one take. Really? Another fun fact that almost probably everyone can guess or knows is that the title of the film comes from the title of the Three Dog Night song, Pieces of April. A fun fact that I really love is that John Gallagher Jr., who I adore. I have the biggest crush on him. I think he's the greatest. He originated the role of Moritz Stiefel in Spring Awakening, so that's why I love him. But I also love him for his role as Tim here. But he and Allison Peel, who plays Beth, would go on to star together in Newsroom as love interests. So they've made a career of playing opposite each other. Did you know that John Gallagher Jr. originated the role of Moritz Stiefel in Spring Awakening?
I did not. You just taught me that.
I've told you that before as we're watching this movie. So the guy who is playing Tim is the same guy who sings Don't Do Sadness.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very talented actor, that John Gallagher Jr., and not too bad to look at.
Now, the girl that played Beth, I tried to figure out what else she was in.
Mm-hmm.
Because she seemed so familiar.
Allison Peel?
Uh-huh.
I don't know what else you would have seen her in. Okay. I mean, you haven't. I don't think you've seen Newsroom, have you?
I don't think so, but she seemed so familiar to me. I usually go and Google and find out all the stuff, but I didn't do it when I was watching this. And so I was trying to, you know, just trying to remember what about her was so familiar. Maybe she reminds me of someone.
Well, people who are my age will remember her from Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I don't think you've seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World. She's also she's in a lot of things. She's in Midnight in Paris, I'm pretty sure. I think she plays Zelda Fitzgerald in that. And you've seen Midnight in Paris, but I don't think that you would remember Zelda Fitzgerald that vividly from that movie. Yeah,
probably not.
And then she's in Vice.
Okay.
She's in Vice. She plays Mary Chaney, daughter of Dick Cheney in that.
Okay.
But I don't know what you would remember her from. But yeah, I think that Allison Peel does have just one of those faces where she looks, I don't know. I'm sure you have seen her in other things because she's had a pretty prolific career. But I do think that she just has one of those faces, you know, where you see her face and you're like, yeah, I know this girl from somewhere.
Yep. I guess that's it.
And then my final fun fact for this film is that this film features Patricia Clarkson's only Oscar-nominated performance to date. She was nominated for the Oscar for her role here as Joy Burns and has not been nominated since.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that the Academy would nominate her for this performance. Not that I don't think it's, like, I absolutely do think it is deserved, but you just don't see the Academy recognizing performances like this all that often, I don't think, you mm-hmm. know.
I thought she did a phenomenal job playing the part. Because, and it, as we discuss it, we'll, yeah. you know, as we, I just, that's one of the things in this third watch that really stood out to me was how versatile she was and how much she could communicate just sitting there staring. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go ahead and jump on into the nitty-gritty of the discussion. And we'll begin, as we always do, with Pitt and Peak. So, Niecy, what was your least favorite part and what was your favorite part of this rewatch experience?
Okay. My least favorite part was when April runs down the stairs. Bobby has come upstairs and told her that her family's there. And she runs down the stairs so joyful, and she gets there and they're gone. That's my least favorite part. So that's my ultimate pit.
Mm-hmm. That is the ultimate pit of the film, uh-huh. I think. So it would be mine too, but I'll pick a different one since you picked that one. The first thing that sprang to mind is somehow simultaneously both a pit and a peak for me. So that might be cheating, but I'm gonna go for it. It's the moment after April has finally, she's retrieved her turkey from Wayne, and she sits down on the stairs and he yells, "You're a bad girl." And she just quietly goes, "No, I'm not." And that's the reason that's both a pit and a peak for me, is because this rewatch in particular, it jumped out at me. I was like, whoa, she's heard that so many times before. Like, she has been told, "You're a bad girl." And I just get the sense that this might be the first time she ever says anything back. And she says, "No, I'm not."
Yeah, that's, I can see that. That's what I felt from that, was that that's something that's so familiar to her. That's what she's been told, that's what she has believed, but there's something where she's reaching deep within herself to say, that's not me, I don't have to be labeled that way. And I feel like that's like her rejecting that and bouncing back from something that has been, you know, is rejecting her label, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like that might be the first time she ever definitively does that. So it's both a pit and a peak. One other moment that I want to mention on pits, though, is the moment, I think the line itself is really funny, but the moment itself is very heartbreaking, of course, when Joy, after Beth says, "Any requests?" and Joy says, "That you stop."
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole car just gets so quiet. And there's two reasons that's a pit. One, like, you see it play out on Beth's face, just how much that devastates her. And it's so true that a cutting line like that from a parent can just emotionally decimate you more than anything else. And so I do feel for Beth, even though up until that point in the movie, Beth has kind of been the least sympathetic character. You know, like, she's usually the one that I feel the least connection to,
yeah,
up until that point in the movie, you know, but it is still sad to see the emotions play out on her face of just how taken aback and scarred she is by what her mother just said. But another thing that makes that even worse of a pit to me is the fact that Joy is able to immediately acknowledge, like, oh, I shouldn't have said that, and apologize for it, when you get the sense she's never recognized that she shouldn't have said or done certain things in her relationship with April, you know? So the implication there is that she can apologize to Beth because she values her relationship with Beth, but because April's the first pancake, she doesn't take any responsibility for what she has done to sabotage her relationship with April, you know?
Yeah, I see that completely. And I'm like you, that Beth, from the beginning, I had no real connection with her. She was that person that could just really grate on me, you know, and you can tell that her persistence in asking the questions about her mom's health and all, she can really grate on her mom, but you can tell that her mom values her. And then, but Beth does a great job of communicating that emotion when her mama breaks her, when she makes that request. And that's when I was like, this girl is good. And I've appreciated her more this time than I have in times past. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, me too. I got to say that on this rewatch, Beth, because I will say, since if we're about to move on to peaks, my peak on many rewatches has been the moment where April and Beth hug in the picture.
Uh-huh.
And, or it's actually in a video, it's like in a little video clip that's interspliced there with all the pictures at the end, where there's the moment where April leans over and she whispers something to Beth and Beth whispers something back and then they embrace. And I've always really liked that moment, because the more I rewatch the movie, the more I feel like Beth is a sympathetic character, because you get the sense that she's just trying to keep the family together. You know, like she kind of is forced into that role because no one else is stepping up and doing it. And I noticed that particularly on this rewatch, how often she's the one goading Joy into admitting that when she's talking about Smack Daddy, which I should have mentioned in fun facts, that whole monologue about how Smack Daddy is singing directly to her and everything was the only thing that was taken verbatim from Peter Hedges' own experience with his own mother going through cancer.
Uh-huh.
Now, it wasn't Smack Daddy. It was some other artist. But is Smack Daddy a real artist? I don't know. But it was some real artist that his mother went on a diatribe about how he was singing directly to her. So I just thought that was a funny little tidbit. But, you know, when Joy is going off on that little diatribe, Beth keeps being like Dad, or, you know, don't you love Dad? And then when they're at the diner, Beth is like, oh, I think we'll be able to find something for everyone here. And she's the one making small talk with the waitress. And so I just feel like Beth is the one who's trying to hold things together and give the family a sense of normalcy and a sense of function rather than dysfunction. You know?
Yes, I can certainly see that. And she is the one who's interjecting and the one who, I think you're exactly right. She feels like she's carrying the weight, because you don't get that from the father. And you feel like Tim or Timmy's just, you know, he's just there having a good time with his mom whenever she wants his dash. And so anyway, but I would agree with you about Beth.
Mm-hmm. So what's your peak, Niecy?
My peak? I have... My ultimate peak, of course, is when she thinks they're gone, and she starts sharing her meal with the Asians, and then her family comes in, and I love that. But I have what I've written down as a sub peak too. Okay, and okay. What I've got is my sub peak is when Bobby, he's going through all of the, you know, riding his little scooter and finding out that Tyrone, Terrell, Latrell, whatever's looking for him. And so then, you know, you have all these things that you're thinking that Bobby's trying to do. And then when you realize he's trying to buy a suit to make himself presentable to her family, that just really, I love that. That's my sub peak.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you say that, because my ultimate peak on this rewatch is Bobby's whole monologue to Latrell, where he's talking about how he's like, you've never been in love. And Latrell's like, nah, I've never been in love. And he's like saying it like being in love is such an awful thing, because he doesn't want to be whipped like Bobby is whipped. And he says something about Bobby's mom, and Bobby says, you didn't know my mom, and I pity you for that. And then he launches into this whole spiel about how when you are in love, you can feel motivated and endowed to do crazy things that you never could do without that love there to motivate you. And he tells a story about a car, being involved in a car accident, and his mom lifting the car off of him. And that, I've seen this movie quite a few times, but that line is something that has like transcended just this movie to me. Like, it just floats around in my brain. And there have been times where I've not been able to place where that little story or anecdote came from, but I knew that there was a piece of media that I loved where there was an anecdote about a mom lifting a car. And so on this rewatch, it all fell into place. And I was like, oh yeah, that's where that line came from. But I love that line. I love the defensiveness with which Bobby says, you didn't know my mama, and I pity you for that, because there's such a richness to all of the different levels and all of the different types of relationships with mothers portrayed in this movie. Although April and Joy are the central mother-daughter relationship, you also have the relationship between Joy and Beth. You have the relationship between Joy and her mother. You have Bobby's mother, who we never see, but she still is a presence that looms large. You have Yvette, who is like a maternal figure. You know, you've just got a bunch of different types of maternal relationships presented in this movie. And I love, though, that what Bobby's saying is that you can do crazy things that you shouldn't have the strength or willpower to do for your loved ones. And that's kind of the core of this movie to me, is that April is doing something that I don't think she really wants to do and that she shouldn't be able to do, but she's finding it within her or within the community around her to be able to do these things because she loves people. You know, like, she's doing this for her family because she loves them, and it's not easy and it's not something she enjoys, but she's doing it anyway because of the love. She's motivated by the love.
Exactly. And she is something she certainly has no experience with, but at 8 o'clock, she's finding out her oven is not working. So she, you know, she's getting up at 7. It's a hard thing for her to do, you know. And that's one of the things that stands out to me, is how she struggled getting up. But once she got up, she was so committed to the day. And you could tell it was totally out of her element. But she wanted to step out of her so she could, and what she's comfortable with, to have that connection with her family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So on the subject of her being so committed and her struggling, my next question is, do you have any favorite shots? And I think that segue works, because some of the best shots in this movie to me are her and Bobby preparing that turkey.
Exactly. I love that.
Them sticking just the full onion in the turkey is priceless to me. But do you have any favorite shots from this movie, Niecy?
Okay, if we're going all the way back to like the beginning, now when the turkey, when they drop it in the floor, that's hilarious to me. Okay. And a shot that's just kind of haunting to me, but I like it because it stood out, is when, okay, I've just mentioned you've got April who's struggling getting up, and I love the way Bobby's just persistent with her, you know, about her getting up. And I mean, he picks her up and puts her in the shower. I love that. I thought that was hilarious. But then the haunting shot is taking place at her parents' house. And when her dad is looking for her mom, and everybody starts looking for her, and that she's sitting there in the car, and that shot of when you know, the garage, and you see her just sitting there with that blank stare on her face, that is like a haunting shot to me. And as far as it being my favorite, like the whatever, that's not my favorite shot, but it is a shot that stands out to me. So that's our first introduction to a woman named Joy, who, you know, you would never, ever dream that her name is Joy when you see her. So that's one of the standout shots. My favorite shot is of April's feet when she's going down the stairs, and she's excited because Bobby's told her they're down there. And the shot of the descent, as she comes down the stairs, goes out on the street, they're not there. And then you have the shot of her feet as she slowly, and you can tell she's just so broken by just the way she takes the steps going up.
And she's popping the balloons as she goes back up. I love that you get that just from the sound and the way her feet are stopping on every step, you know? Because that's one of my favorite things in this movie. It's not necessarily a shot, but it bears mentioning, is the, you know, Bobby has bought all these decorations, and then she sends him out for the day, and she catches him putting the sign on the door with like the turkey. And she says, they don't deserve decorations. But then she spends a pretty significant part of her day blowing up balloons and hanging them all through the hallway and the stairwell. Like she's putting out decorations for her family, even though she told Bobby they didn't deserve it, you know? So that makes the moment of her ascending the stairs so slowly and popping every balloon on her ascent, like, pretty heartbreaking.
Yes, it does. And it literally, that's what it did. Your heart breaks for her. And if she does that, because, you know, it was such an effort for her. Like I said earlier, the cooking's not her comfort zone. Decorating's not her comfort zone. And she's just doing everything she can because she really wants this day to be so special. And just me personally, I don't like to cook, okay? And it would take a lot for me to go to the lengths that she went to fix a meal.
This rewatch, I was like, dang, April, Bobby, just go to the store. Like, buy something. You know, like she does go to such great lengths to try to make this a memorable and good Thanksgiving for her family. I'm glad that you mentioned the feet, though, because that's a recurring bit of visual imagery that is featured quite often throughout the movie. Is it lingers on people's feet. It's a lot of times it's April's feet, but there are a few times where it's Joy's feet or another character's feet that we see. And my favorite shot deals with another recurring bit of visual imagery that we get throughout the film, which is there's a lot of use of mirrors in this film. And the mirrors usually are used in reference or with Joy's character. You see her gazing in mirrors quite a bit. And I'm a sucker for mirrors being used in films. I always point it out. Every time I'm watching a movie and there's a bunch of mirror imagery, it's used a lot in Jackie. It's used a lot in Black Swan. It's used a lot in a lot of my favorite films. But so there's mirrors used in the moment of epiphany for Joy, where she sees the young girl in the bathroom stall being abandoned by her mother, which is a very important moment that we can talk about later under performance if we would like to. But there's also a mirror used in the scene where she's partaking from Tim's stash. And you actually see Joy like framed off to the side of the shot, and you see Tim in the mirror, you know. But my favorite shot comes when the grandma first gets in the car, and Joy has just had a line about how she's going to, like, when she gets old. She says something about when she gets old, and the unspoken part there is that no one else, no one in the car believes she's ever going to be old, you know. And then the grandmother gets in the car and she's in the back seat, and the shot is just like Joy's view of the rearview mirror. And so you see like half of Joy's face, and then you see her mother looming behind her, and the camera just kind of lingers there for a moment. And I think that there's something to be said for like I said, there's so many different types of mother-daughter relationships portrayed in this movie. And the one that perhaps gets the least fleshing out is the relationship between Joy and her mother. But there's that shot just was really striking to me on this rewatch for a couple of reasons. One, I think there's a moment of resentment for Joy in that moment where she's like, I'll never get to be this, you know, where she's, because like I said, it's like the movie has just acknowledged that she will never get to grow old. And so she's looking at her mother and seeing what she could be and realizing that she'll probably never actually be that. And then also, it's never explicitly stated, but it's very strongly implied that the grandmother has Alzheimer's or dementia. And it's an interesting notion to me. You have Joy looking in the mirror and seeing her mother, and it's like they've both been betrayed by their humanity or by their bodies or by their minds, but in different ways, you know? Like Joy's cancer has stolen her joy and has stolen what she, like all she hoped to be when she got older. And then her mother's, whatever her ailment is, Alzheimer's, dementia, like it's stolen all of her memories.
Right.
You know, because she gets in the car and all she says is, I know you. And Joy says, hi, mom, did you eat today? You know, and it's just, it's interesting. I don't know. I feel like they were trying to communicate a lot in that one shot of Joy locking eyes with her mother in the mirror.
And I agree with you there. And I had actually, in watching the shot, it stood out to me this time, but I didn't make note of it, but it's that shot. I think it has stood out to me every time I've watched it actually, but I think you did a good job of encapsulating what, let's see, what all they were showing there. And I think you're exactly right, because I think she does feel that weight, because everybody in the car really knows she's not going to grow old. And then, you know, and I know I've always thought that she also thought, you know, is this what I would be?
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't have this, would I be dealing with that? Because, you know, the kids, Timmy and Beth, introduced themselves to their grandmother. And then when April's name comes up, she thought, you know, it's so sad because she thought April was dead, you know, because. So anyway.
That line makes me laugh every time, though, I gotta say.
So I thought she was dead. So.
So speaking of I thought she was dead, do you have a favorite line from this movie?
I don't know if I do have a favorite line. This one's kind of corny or whatever, but I loved it. I've already mentioned how Bobby was so persistent about getting her out of bed and putting her in the shower and all that kind of stuff. But one of the first lines that we get is, this is your big day. You don't want to miss this opportunity. And I loved it that he loved her so much, and he knew this was so important to her that he wasn't going to allow her to miss this. And so I love that, because he's waking her up and he's saying, you know, you're going to face this. This is your opportunity. And I love that line. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Bobby has some really great lines. Speaking of those early moments, though, a line that always makes me laugh and that I really enjoy is after he's carried her to the shower and she's taken her shower, he's like trying to get her, spur her along, trying to get her moving. And she says, I'm coming. And you see that she's just sitting there in the bathroom. And she goes, I'll be right there. And that's just relatable to me. You know, the I'm coming, I'm moving, I'll be right there. But she's just sitting still in the bathroom. A moment that always makes me laugh that I really love is it's a tight shot like through the car's windshield. And you just hear Joy say, now tell me, how could anyone not believe that there is a God? And then it pans out and you see that they're sitting in the parking lot of a Krispy Kreme. And they're all eating donuts. And that one just gets me. Like, the first time I watched the movie, that's the hardest I laughed, I'm pretty sure.
Well, that was...
that line?
I'm sorry. I had that one written down as my second favorite line, actually. It was, really? Yes, because I could see us doing that.
Yeah, no, that's our family. We have to stop for donuts on every road trip.
So,
I also like them burying the squirrel, which also feels like something our family would get involved in somehow.
Yeah, I love that. I had made notes of that, and it was just, now I couldn't see your dad letting us stop on a road trip to do it, okay? But it would be something that the girls would want to do, and, you know, we have buried a couple of animals or two, but, and I don't know if you'll get to it or whatever, but I love the whole exchange with Yvette and Eugene, and when they're helping April, you know, giving her the time with the turkey, and something about him reminded me of my Bubba. And I just love that, you know, because he's got to cook things a certain way. And nobody, you know, she said that she liked cranberry sauce from a can, and nobody likes it from a can. And I love that whole, their part in the story of April's day was one of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I like Yvette and Eugene. They loom large over the rest of the movie. Like, even though they're only featured very briefly, they make, I think, the biggest impact out of all of the random assortment of neighbors that we encounter. And I'm always so happy when they show up at the end in the pictures of the Thanksgiving celebration.
Yes.
I love Yvette's first line, though. Her being like, she's young, she's got her youth. I cannot wait to hear this privileged white girl's problems. Like... It's and then it cuts to her sobbing, you know, like she's so moved by April's problems. And that, something that stuck out to me in April and Yvette's, going back and forth in their conversation that I had never noticed before this rewatch is April says that, she doesn't explicitly say that she's 21 years old, but she says that she was 18 3 years ago. And that, when I realized that April's only 21, like, that just puts everything in a totally different light for me now, because now I'm older than April on this rewatch. And like, that just seems like such a child to be living on your own in New York City and be, you know, trying to throw this epic family Thanksgiving and just make your family proud. You know, like, that just... I don't know. It puts an extra weight on her, I feel like, to make her that young.
And I would agree. And you know what? I'll have to be totally transparent here. I missed her age. And I didn't realize she was 21. I would have had her about 23 is what I would have had her at. But that's still so young, trying to deal with all that she was dealing with.
Mm-hmm. One other line that I really want to mention is that I like it when Jim says that he really has high expectations for this Bobby guy, because apparently this Bobby guy reminds her of me. And then his reaction when he sees Bobby for the first time lets us know how comedic that comparison is.
That's right. And I had written that one down too as one of my favorite lines, because, you know, he's just beaming because of that. And then you're like, when he sees him, you're absolutely right. It brings a lot of comedic value to that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's that the setup for that line too is really important to the overall narrative of the story, where he's saying that, you know, Eddie the drug dealer's out of the picture. Like, I really feel like this film, I like how like bottled the story is. Like, we only encounter all these people on this one day, but we really get the sense that we've known them for much longer than that. But I think that it's very important that this is the place where we encounter April. So, like, we don't have the baggage that all these other characters have in their view of April. We never saw her dating a drug dealer. We never saw her on drugs. We never saw her making all of these awful decisions that we hear about throughout the movie. So it helps her be much more sympathetic to us as viewers, you know? But I think that it's just an interesting screenwriting decision that Peter Hedges made to, like, reveal all of this expository information throughout the script, but like, we never see these characters outside of this one day. And I think that that's really important for the relationships that we have with these characters.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the thing is, you do feel like that whatever baggage has been brought to this moment and all the things that may have been said to April, and as you get to know Joy's character, you realize Joy can be so cutting, and you can't imagine what she would have said and how she would have treated April. Because one of the things that got me was when she was like, she wanted everybody to listen to her, and you really thought it was going to be a profound moment, you know, and she was fixing to tell them something important, and maybe, you know, even had something to do with her having cancer. And then she says, each of you in your own way are going to have to figure out or handle how you're going to discard your food. And that was such a cut to April, because we could see what April's doing on the other end and how hard she's trying. But I think when Bobby had said to her, this is your opportunity, I think that it was because it was a day that April was willing to put all that behind her just to reach one more time to have a relationship. And so I think it was, I agree with you, we only get this day, but I think that with April, in April's mind, it didn't matter. She's desperate to have that connection with her family.
Yeah, I completely agree. So my one last favorite line that I have to mention, which I think is my ultimate favorite line from the movie, is when April is trying to explain Thanksgiving to her neighbors. And she starts off with, so long ago, there were these people that looked like me, came over in a ship called the Mayflower, landed on this big rock, and their first year on their own, it was hard. It was really, really hard. And then she looks around, she's like, let me start over. And then she starts talking about, this was years ago, before we stole all their land and shipped the rest of them off to reservations. And then she's like, wait. But then when she finally lands on how to present Thanksgiving to people who've never experienced Thanksgiving, what she says that makes Thanksgiving so special is that once there was a day where everyone realized that they needed each other, the one day where they knew they couldn't do it alone. And that's the essence of this whole movie, you know, is that it takes a village, it takes a community. And that's what April realizes. And that's, this movie kind of is like a modern retelling of the Thanksgiving narrative that we all get spoon-fed as primary schoolers, which is that, like, it was a day all about community where everyone came together and relied on one another and made this great meal. And then they all sat down and enjoyed it together. And even though that's not, you know, necessarily truthful or pedagogically sound, that that's what we teach young children about exactly how Thanksgiving came to be, like, that is what this movie is. It's a community of people that on the surface seemingly have nothing in common. You know, it's people from different races, different backgrounds, different, you know, completely different in every conceivable and observable way. And then they all band together to make this Thanksgiving meal. And at the end, they sit down and enjoy it together.
Exactly. And that's something that is so striking is when she's telling that and she's putting it in those terms, it's like, this time I was like, it was so profoundly spoken to me that this is what's happened. I mean, it was one of those things where, let's see, it was in your face that this is what's happening. It wasn't one of those little subtle things, you know, because, you know, what she's explaining or what she's trying to communicate to these people with this language barrier is that what happened that day is exactly what's happening in her life today.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Did you have any other favorite lines you wanted to mention before we move on?
No. I thought it was when the mom, it showed the Lincoln Tunnel and all that kind of stuff. You know, they're getting into the city and they're coming in the city to see April, and the dad looks over and the mom's asleep. And that scene is just a pretty heavy scene. Cause even though as the viewer, I never felt like even the first time I saw it that she had actually died in the car, but you can see those thoughts going through her husband's head, and everybody gets tense, and you have that moment where you want to make sure the person's still there with you. And I think that's just if you've ever gone through a sickness with someone, you know, you have those moments, and you knew exactly what was going through their heads, even though me as the viewer didn't feel like she had passed away. And that's just such a scene that's striking to me. And it stands out. And then her mom didn't know what was going on, but Beth and Timmy were very well aware of what was going through their dad's head.
Mm-hmm. I love that scene culminates in Beth just saying, "Dad thought," and then pausing.
Yes, I do too.
Because that's another thing with this film is that there's so much that's not explicitly said. Like, you know, you brought it out earlier, the moment where everyone thinks Joy is finally about to verbally acknowledge that they're all going to have to figure out a way to cope with her death soon. But she never actually says that. And there's so much in this movie that is never said. It's just alluded to. And so, I think that, again, that moment where Beth is the one that says, "Well, Daddy thought," that drives home to me. That's another moment where I'm like, okay, maybe I do have some connection to Beth. Maybe I do feel for her, because that's one moment where you realize that all of this stuff that she's doing, all the lengths she's going to, all of the outs she's giving them where she wants them to back out and say they're not going to go to April's, it's not because she's like a cruel person. It's because she wants this day to be perfect, because she wants to give her mom the perfect last Thanksgiving because she truly believes it's going to be her last one.
Yes,
you know?
I agree.
So, but that scene, it's definitely not my favorite scene, but I think it might be one of the most powerful scenes in the whole movie. Yeah. So, one thing I wanted to mention, which you brought it up in when you were talking about some of your favorite aspects of the film, you know, Bobby's going to all these lengths to do this thing and you don't know what it is. And something that I was very struck by on this rewatch is that, you know, this is a show, this podcast is dedicated to the value of the rewatch. This is the first movie that I've covered on this podcast that while I was rewatching it, I found myself longing for my first watch. Like, I wanted to be able to experience my first viewing of this movie again. And, you know, I'm a big believer in the value of the rewatch. I love rewatching media. I love reconsuming media, whether it's, you know, movies, TV shows, books. But this movie in particular, there is something so special about the first time you get to watch it, because so much of this movie deals with suspense. with, you don't know if April's going to succeed in the race against time. You don't know what Bobby is off doing for the first two-thirds of the movie. Like, I genuinely, the first time I watched it, thought that he was going to participate in a drug deal. Because you hear the line where her dad says, oh, she's done with her drug dealer boyfriend, you know? And you know that that's not Bobby, but you know that April has a history of using drugs and dating a drug dealer. And so when it's revealed that Bobby is just going to buy a suit, like, that absolutely is a subversion of the expectations that have been built up in that storyline, you know? And another thing that deals with suspense is Joy's entire health problem. Like, they don't say the word cancer for at least 20 or 30 minutes into the movie. And so you know that something's wrong, but you don't know what it is specifically that they're dealing with. And so I would just really like to watch this movie for the first time again, not knowing where all these storylines are going and not knowing all of what the movie itself is dealing with. Because I think that, I don't know, it'd just be very interesting to see how it would all pay off as a viewer if you could have that first time experience again, not knowing what Bobby's doing, not knowing what Joy is dealing with, not knowing how the movie is going to resolve itself, you know? Right.
And the not knowing if she's ever going to be able to get that turkey cooked.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I want to ask you, Niecy, what do you think makes this film such a good Thanksgiving movie?
That's a good question, Kyla. I think, you know, invariably holidays are times that bring people together, and the perseverance and persistence that April shows, even though she's the outcast, the daughter that they seem to would rather forget about, her wanting that connection. And so many times on just the mundane days of the year, people lose connection and contact with one another. And so, she wants her whole family, but you know she's wanting that time with her mom. And just the fact that she goes through everything to try to make the day perfect for her mom. And you know that's the driving force behind it. And so that coming together, that getting that moment. And so that's what Thanksgiving is about. I, you know, some people seem to forget about Thanksgiving, and you said something earlier that there's not that many movies out there about Thanksgiving. You can watch a Christmas movie every day of the year from probably every day of the year, but you know, you let just a hint of us making that run towards Thanksgiving and Christmas movies just dominate everything. But sometimes for some people, Thanksgiving is the real holiday about just family being together. And I think that's what this movie communicates. I mean, everybody gets together at Christmas, but at Christmas, the emphasis is on what you're giving and what you're getting. But Thanksgiving is the day where you just come together as family. And that's what this movie does. It brings those reconnections, and it brings the mother and the daughter together, and it brings the sisters to, you know, you mentioned the hug earlier, it brings them together. It's just bringing family together and being thankful that you have family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I also think that one thing this movie does really well that makes it such a good Thanksgiving movie is like that point that I mentioned earlier about how the narrative that we all want to believe was the first Thanksgiving is that people who seemingly had nothing in common came together as a community. Uh-huh. And that's what this movie illustrates. It is April and her biological family, but it's also April creates this little found family with all the people that live in her apartment building, you know? And so there's something very like profound and powerful and moving about that as well. And I agree with you that, you know, I mentioned earlier and you just brought it up that we just don't have Thanksgiving movies. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that the market has not been cornered for Thanksgiving movies yet?
I don't know. I think it's because Christmas is just so commercialized, and that's all the emphasis comes, you know, on Christmas, and you know, Thanksgiving just gets bypassed. So, you know, if you're going to make a good Christmas movie, everybody's in, you know, you got the Christmas music, you got all that kind of stuff that you add to the Christmas experience, and people don't, you just don't have that much around Thanksgiving. And so I think everybody should get the turkey salt and pepper shakers myself and have Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the salt and pepper shakers, because I meant to mention that under favorite lines, when she says Joy made me put them down, told me that they were worth more than I was. And then she asks how much Bobby spent on them. And his first response is, oh, they weren't cheap.
Yeah, I like that line too.
And she knows he's lying, but it's a generous lie, to quote the other Blend girl. I also just want to mention, while we're on the subject of there not being many Thanksgiving movies, you know, I said I've seen this movie almost every year on Thanksgiving for the past 10 years or so. But this rewatch in particular, I enjoyed it in a completely different way. And I want to encourage people, hopefully if you've made it this far in the episode, you've seen the movie before. But if you haven't watched this movie yet this year, I would really encourage you to watch it, because I think with a lot of us not being able to physically be present with family on Thanksgiving, that this movie is all the more impactful and all the more powerful, you know? Like, it's, I don't know, I just think that in this particular Thanksgiving season, the message of community and found family and everything is just, it hits all the closer to home right now.
I agree with you there, Boo.
So I was going to ask, are there any technical strengths of the film that you think bear mentioning in our conversation, Niecy?
Technical strengths of the film? Well, you've already mentioned, you and I have a couple of other movies that were shot with just a couple of cameras that me and you end up, the one we like the most is the one that was shot in the most simplistic way. But as far as the way this movie was shot, it was like it was real life instead of, you know, like this unrelatable, technical production. And I think that's part of the value of the film, and one thing that makes it so endearing is it's so, even the way it's shot, it is just so relatable, and it's so real. And I think that this you know, I think the lack of super duper technology and all of that kind of stuff being used in this is to the asset of the movie. I think it's one of the strengths of the movie.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that it being shot digitally on handheld cameras was genius. It was so inspired. I know that that decision was more than likely made because of budgetary reasons, but I would like to believe that it would have been made as an artistic choice regardless of the budget, because it just adds so much to the movie. And you're absolutely right. It enhances the realism. And I think that the realism of this film is its ultimate strength. Like those unsaid things, those moments where important things are left unsaid, and then we just kind of linger in the silence with the characters. Like, that's so realistic. That's so true to life. And those moments are made all the more lifelike because of the manner in which they are shot, you know? And so I think that so many things that were done for budgetary concerns ended up being to the strength of this film. Like the fact that most of the scenes were shot on the first take. Like, it comes across as so natural and realistic because it's the actor's first reading of it. you know.
Right. I agree with that. I want to tell you something. I hadn't mentioned this, and this is kind of changing maybe the subject a little bit. One thing that struck me was, you know, even with her crazy dyed hair, and there were some shots in this movie where Katie Holmes was so striking. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were just a couple of times where it was just on her face, and it just captured her. I mean, because you know it wasn't like made up, fancy makeup, whatever beauty. It was just natural beauty. And I've always thought Katie Holmes was pretty, but there were just some really simple shots of her that were just, I thought she's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that this film, which we're about to begin conversation on the performances specifically. And so obviously we'll give Katie Holmes her due there. But just in terms of Katie Holmes's appearance, I think that I wasn't alive for this, or I was an infant for this, so I don't remember it. But there was a huge thing in Hollywood at the end of the 1990s where everyone was trying to cast a Katie Holmes type. Like, that was a thing where Katie Holmes, I believe that someone called her the Audrey Hepburn of her generation because of how striking she was and just, like, the natural grace that oozed from her. And it's a girl next door quality where she is so strikingly beautiful, but you honestly believe you could come across her in real life. Does that make sense? Yeah, that makes
perfect sense.
And so I think that it's hilarious to me that there was such a clamoring for the Katie Holmes type. And then Katie Holmes's career kind of fizzled horribly. And I still believe, like, I genuinely think that Katie Holmes is a very naturally talented actress. I think that she's very graceful. I think that she's very charismatic. And I would love for her to get her due even now. You know, like, I would love for her to have a performance that is just universally lauded, and we all can finally get to the point where we can acknowledge that Katie Holmes is a very talented actress, because I know I'm biased. I know Joey Potter is one of my favorite fictional characters of all time, so, like, my opinion is not impartial at all, but I really think that Katie Holmes, we have not fully tapped into her potential as an actress yet.
And I would agree with that, and I'm sorry that we have not. I think it has been, let's see, our loss. And I do hope that there is something out there that really does tap into who she is and what she's capable of. And, you know, I like her in the Kennedys, and,
She is,
but again, that still, I don't think that still communicates all that she is and what she can do. I don't know that there's been anything that has fully showcased her gifts and her talents. And I didn't mean to jump ahead, but I know we'll talk about her in just a minute when we discuss.
I just want to make the joke right here. You said her gifts, and Katie Holmes is in a film called The Gift, and Katie Holmes is in the film The Giver. And so when I was at the peak of my Dawson's Creek obsession and was watching, like, all of Katie Holmes' filmography over and over again, it's a thing in I know in evangelical churches we say this a lot. I don't know if other traditions and denominations say this all that often, but a lot of times when people are praying over the offering, they'll say, "And bless the gift and the giver." And I would, under my breath, be like, "Both Katie Holmes films," every time someone would pray that. So that's just my little Kyla joke for the moment about Katie Holmes's filmography. When you said her gifts, I was like, yes, the gift and the giver. And I made you go see The Giver with me in theaters. I don't know if you remember that, because it was the first Katie Holmes movie that had come out in quite a bit of time. Like, she hadn't been in a theatrically released film in a while. I could be getting this wrong on the timing, but I believe that The Giver was her first movie that came out post the Tom Cruise divorce.
Mm-hmm. And I remember us going to see it. So I do.
a great cast for a movie that maybe didn't deserve that great of a cast, but oh well. I mean, like, Meryl Streep is in that movie. It was like Meryl Streep, Katie Holmes, Jeff Bridges, Brenton Thwaites. Anyways, but the plot just wasn't that memorable. It wasn't a great adaptation of The Giver, but we're not here to talk about The Giver. Let's talk about performances in Pieces of April. So obviously the two most memorable performances, at least to me, are Patricia Clarkson as Joy and Katie Holmes as April. Other than those two, though, who do you think that we need to specifically mention? I mean, I think that it's a great cast all the way through. It's not a very big cast. Like, it's a pretty small ensemble, you know. But I still would call it an ensemble because everyone has their moment to shine.
Exactly. Of course, I think we need to mention Bobby. I thought, and I love the story that you told about how he was like the last, you know, at the last minute, as far as being cast for that part. But he just captured, let's see, like when he was talking, when he was behind the suit and he was talking about love, you really believed that person was not acting, that person was genuinely in love and knew what it was. And I just, you know, I thought he had a great performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think what a crazy compliment to get from the director the man who's directing you, who was the screenwriter of the film that launched Leonardo DiCaprio's career, to say that you are the greatest audition he's seen since Leonardo DiCaprio, and that your talent level is comparable to Leonardo DiCaprio's.
Exactly.
Like, that's huge. I think that Derek Luke does a phenomenal job as Bobby. He makes Bobby so lovable. And this is something that every character does, but that every actor does with their character in this film. But like, you really feel like you know Bobby, even though you only are seeing him on this one day, you know?
Yeah.
I like the way that he can realistically portray Bobby as like being all smiles and so happy for April, having just been like horribly beaten up by the gang on bicycles, you know? Like, it's just, he imbues Bobby with so much joy, you know? And that's a character decision that Derek Luke did not have to make. Like, I don't think the screenplay necessarily required that Bobby be that unerringly joyful, but he did that, and I really enjoy it.
Yeah, I do too. And that's the word, I think, to use right there, Kyla, is joyful. And her having that perfect day, that opportunity that he wasn't going to let her miss. You can tell that the thoughts of that brings him joy, and he wants to do everything he can to make it as perfect as possible for her. So I love the way he plays that part.
I do too. And I really do think that Allison Peel and John Gallagher Jr. both do really great jobs as Beth and Timmy, respectively.
I do too. And, you know, Timmy he's such a subtle character, but he's a memorable character. And, you know, and I love the relationship that is communicated there between he and his mom. You know, he's her go-to. And then, you know, he's a photographer, but just the things that are communicated, even through his shots, you know, is powerful. I think those were excellent choices for those two roles.
Yeah, I agree. I think that John Gallagher Jr., we've already mentioned it with Allison Peel in the scene where Joy says that you stop as her request, but there are multiple moments where John Gallagher Jr. just does everything with his face too, where he's just in the back seat of the car and his mouth is slightly agape, and you can just see the worry in the scene where Jim leans over to tap Joy to see if she's still alive, you know?
Yep.
Poor Oliver Platt. I just don't have that much to say about Jim. I think that he's fine as him. I just feel like he's kind of a non-entity.
Right. He's like the doormat in the movie.
Right. But I feel like, I guess someone had to be like the everyman straight character that doesn't, you know, that just doesn't, I don't know, carry as much emotional depth within them as everyone else. Otherwise, maybe would have been overloaded at some point.
Right, but to his credit, you know, it's not that he played it anything over the top, but he was going to make sure that they at least went to April's. You know, that was, mm-hmm. you know, he wanted to make that happen. And, you know, even, you know, the part he played in that I thought was good. But like I said, he didn't, he's just kind of there. It's the only way I know to put it. But you're right. Somebody had to play that kind of part. And I think he did a good job playing it.
So who should we discuss first? Patricia Clarkson as Joy or Katie Holmes as April?
I would say probably Joy, because Katie's your that's going to be the one you want to wrap up on.
Okay. All right. So Patricia Clarkson as Joy. What do you got for me, Niecy?
You've already said something about, let's see, Timmy and Beth. There was so much that was communicated just in their faces. And that's one of the things that stood out to me overall with this movie that I don't think I've necessarily realized my first two watches, was how much just the facial expressions were so important in this. And Joy was phenomenal. She had the ability to communicate so much with a deadpan face. And mm-hmm. Let's see. And then when she was sick in the restrooms, just the look, you know, you didn't have to hear the sounds to know what was going on. And she just, I thought she did just a great job in every way, every delivery of every line. And, you know, I just thought that was a sterling performance.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the moment you're talking about how much she can do with just a completely deadpan look, like it's all in her eyes. And the scene that is the best example of that to me is the final scene with the mirror, where she notices the young girl and the mother leaving her in the restroom. And you see it all without her face even changing.
That's right.
Like you can see how much she's processing in that moment. And that's so commendable that as an actress, she could communicate that without even moving.
And you knew in that moment when that little girl said, "Mom," and she looked, and it was like the little girl had basically been abandoned by her mom. You knew that she was about to, you know, get to her daughter, come hell or high water. And so the means that they took to get there is quite hilarious to me.
Uh-huh. I love grandma looking out the window and just kind of giggling.
I do too.
You know? Uh-huh. It's a good moment. But yeah, Patricia Clarkson, I'm so glad that the Academy recognized her for this performance, that they gave her a nomination for Best Supporting Actress, because like I said, like it surprises me, but not because I don't think that she deserved it. It's just that the Academy gets it wrong on who they nominate for their Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress category so often that I'm surprised that they got it this right this one time, yes. You know, because this would have been a very easy performance for the Academy to overlook, but it's so good. It's so powerful. The fact that Patricia Clarkson has never been nominated again for an Oscar is kind of confounding and crazy, but she's such a talented actress. And again, She's had much more critical success than Katie Holmes, but she's another one that I just feel like we still haven't. She's never had her moment where it's like we've all come together and like truly lauded her with the credit she deserves. But this film is a great, great example of the talent that is within her. And she, the way that she shows the versatility of, like, she'll have you laughing and in stitches one moment, and then you'll be tearing up in the very next scene.
And she can also be so dry. Mm-hmm. You know, because you do have the extreme of emotions. I mean, she makes you feel those emotions, but yet she can just be, just has such a dry approach to humor. And, so to be able to do all of that and play that, you know, play that one character is, you know, like I said, I just thought she did a fantastic job.
Yeah, I did too. And I also thought that my girl Katie Holmes did a pretty fantastic job.
She did. And, you know, from beginning to end, she did. And I don't know, you know, with all of the interminglings with the people in her apartment building and that kind of stuff and the different, you know, each place, each door that she knocked on, she had to play a completely different. I mean, she was still her, but she had to encounter these people. And I thought she did such a great job. Like when she knocked on the lady's door and the lady said, was she a vegan? And Katie Holmes was a vegetarian. Yeah,
I don't need it. She said, I don't need anything that has a face. And April says, oh, I'm a vegetarian. And the lady says, yeah, but I'm a vegan. And the look on Katie Holmes's face makes me giggle every time.
Yes, it did me too. And see, that was such a minuscule scene in the movie. But you think about how you walk away from it. And we're talking, you know, of how, you know, even that, because Kyla, that probably wasn't, what, 30 seconds? In the whole,
but it's memorable,
right? Mm-hmm. And it's so memorable. And then I love the way she and Yvette, you know, how she played the role when she was communicating with Yvette and Eugene. There was so much that was she showed on her face when Eugene would have something to say, and then Yvette's always trying to come in and be like the mediator and make her feel better because Eugene can be abrasive.
And on the subject of that, you know, we've talked about how multiple people in this movie show a lot of things on their face, but one thing that Katie Holmes does better than anyone else in this movie, and it could be because she has the most screen time, but I didn't notice anyone else doing it as effectively as her, is how much she uses her body as an instrument as an actor. Uh-huh. Like the fact that Katie Holmes can seem small in some scenes is crazy, because like Katie Holmes is a very statuesque woman, you know? And so, but when she's talking with Yvette and Eugene, she seems like a small child standing there. And then when she's flirting with Wayne, suddenly she's this striking, tall, beautiful woman, you know? And it's interesting to me because April never changes clothes or her hair or anything throughout this whole movie, but she can look totally different depending on what part of her physicality Katie Holmes chooses to emphasize.
Exactly. And I remember the scene with Wayne, and when she realizes, if I'm going to get to use his oven, I've got to be flirtatious. And the way she just immediately steps into that. And, you know, she just, in that one little apartment building, she has to take on so many different roles, and she does it, and she does it well. So I thought, and I've already talked to you about the shots with her where she was so striking and so pretty. And like you said, she wasn't changing clothes. She was just, you know, it wasn't like I said earlier, she didn't have this huge makeup job on, going on, but she was just so strikingly pretty to be in that kind of, it was just beauty in that environment, and she provided it.
Mm-hmm. And I've said that I point to this performance for all the people who don't agree that Katie Holmes is a great actress. I also would like to point to this performance for all the people who think that all Katie Holmes knows how to do as an actress is just that quirky little half smile. You know, like SNL gets a lot of mileage out of that. Anytime anyone impersonates Katie Holmes, all they have to do is just do the little half smile, you know, and she does use that a lot. But the fact that she convincingly portrays so much on her face in this film is a testament to the fact that she uses the entirety of her face as her instrument. And it's not just, oh, let me just coast through on my looks, you know.
Exactly.
So before we close out, there are two final things I want us to touch on. The first is, I think we haven't mentioned this, but there are some very strong transitions in this movie. Like, there are some very strong moments, thanks to the editing, where we cut from one scene to another, and it's, like, completely seamless in the transition. Did you notice that at all on this rewatch?
Help me out here. Give me an example.
The first one that springs to mind for me is there's the moment where Jim is going to zip up Beth's dress, and he moves to zip it, and you hear the zipping sound effect, but what you're seeing is actually Tim unzipping his camera bag.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that I remember that now, but I didn't really think about it at the time.
Mm-hmm. There's that one. There's a lot of them where it's like the line that was just said in the previous scene is like made even funnier by the shot that you see in the next, in after the transition. So I just thought that was something interesting, that on a film with such a minimal budget and such a minimal amount of time, that the editing went above and beyond to put it over the top, you know?
I would. I wish I had written some of them down, Kyla, because, now that you said that, I remember even thinking it while I was doing the rewatch, about a couple of the seamless transitions, and I wish I had made note of them, because right now I really can't recall them.
Well, it's just something that I wanted to make mention of, that I think that the editing was really great on this film.
And I would agree with that.
And then the last thing we got to talk about, of course, is that ending. I said to you before we started recording that this is not a movie that I think of very often when people ask me what's your favorite movie ending, but I really think that this is one of the most perfect movie endings of all time. And of course, I'm talking about the fact that the ending is shown to us through Tim's photographs.
Yes. And when I was finishing up yesterday watching it, I was like, I love this ending. I don't think it could have been any more perfect. Of course, I couldn't put it into words like you can as to why it stuck out to me, but I just thought it was ingenious to end it with the different shots of them enjoying their Thanksgiving meal together, that it took so much to get together, but to preserve it in with photograph. I thought that was just incredible. And you've mentioned the little short video of the sisters hugging. That stuck out to me too. But I thought when it was going off yesterday, I thought there could not be a more perfect ending to this movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we've said throughout this conversation, one of the strengths of this movie is the realism, and one of the things that helps bolster the realism is the fact that there are so many things that are left unsaid, because that's realistic to real life, you know, that not everything gets said explicitly out loud. And I think that leaving there being no audio of the resolution of the film is so striking and such a smart move, because one thing this movie deals with is this notion of memories, right? And there's the whole conversation where Joy is like, oh, I've tried so hard to recall a fond memory of April, and I only come up with this one. And she has the one memory that she shares, and then of course Beth is like, that was me. And then, and I do love, I think one of the funniest moments in the movie is when Jim is trying to recount his fond April memory, and he begins it with, she was in a pink nightgown, and then Timmy says, no, that was me. And then he's like, sorry. But anyways, the thing is, like, no one has this fond memory with April. No one can recall anything. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was watching the ending of this film is, you know, a lot of our most vivid and cherished memories, we don't really recall the audio from. Like, how many memories do you have where you can actually recall verbatim exactly what was said in that moment? I'm going to guess very few. Like, I have a great memory, and there are some conversations I can recall verbatim, but usually within like a few days of the conversation having taken place, I no longer can recall it verbatim, you know? But what you always remember, at least in my experience, what I always remember is I always remember images and I always remember emotions. I remember how things looked and I remember how things made me feel. And that's what the ending of this movie does so effectively, is it shows us images, and with the images, it conveys emotion. It shows us how things looked, and just off of that, we are able to perceive how they felt.
Exactly. And that, see, I knew you could put it into words what I was seeing and what I was feeling as it was ending.
And I think it's genius that they establish it from the very outset of the movie that Timmy is a photographer, and that he's trying to capture the waning days of his mother's life, you know? And so utilizing that as a bookend, having that right at the end, having that be the way that the film is resolved is through his photography, is just genius, I think.
Yep. I agree with you, baby.
So is there anything that we haven't said about this movie that you think needs to be mentioned in this conversation?
Not that I can. I just love it that at the end of the movie that she finally goes over to the trash can and she pulls the little turkey salt and pepper shakers out and they become part of the table setting. And I just, those salt and pepper shakers just stand out to me. And so it was like she put behind that negative feeling and the fact that she was just reading trash and she thought, okay, this really can be a part of the day.
Mm-hmm. And it was almost like in doing that, I feel like April is acknowledging that, like it's being acknowledged that these new memories can replace the old ones. Because that's what... That is one of the most memorable moments that Jim has, the dad, is when he does go and he chases down Joy and confronts her as she's trying to hitchhike home and says that, you know, we're going to make new memories. Like, that's what today is going to be. And that's when the salt and pepper shakers are retrieved, that's the sense you get that, okay, from now on, maybe April won't immediately associate those with Joy telling her that they were worth more than her as a child. Maybe she'll now be able to associate it with a happier Thanksgiving memory.
Yep, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Also, one thing that I want to note, I've mentioned the line, but I didn't mention it under favorite lines, and I just mentioned it like in passing, but I use the first pancake comparison all the time in life. Like when I have friends that are the firstborn, because I am not the firstborn in our family, but I'll say that, you know, oh, you're the first pancake. I just love that moment where April says, I was the first pancake. And Yvette's like, what? And Eugene immediately supplies, she's the one you're supposed to throw out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I just think that that's a genius and very succinct way of summing up how a lot of firstborn children feel.
Mm-hmm.
So, don't know if Michael Riley would agree with that assessment. She'll have to listen to the episode and let us know. I'm sure she'll listen. She's a great and supportive sister like that. All right, Niecy, anything else you want to say before we close out?
No, I just would have got on the back of the motorcycle too.
All right, so I'm gonna ask you the closing question that I posed to all my guests, which is, is this a movie worth rewatching, and how would you convince someone of that fact?
I would have to say it is a movie that is worth rewatching. To convince somebody, so you want me to convince somebody to watch it again? Rather, okay,
yeah,
because it's one of those things, one of those movies that each time. What I'm blown away by, and I've used this once in referring to Timmy, is there's so many subtle things that you don't get the first time. And I think part of the reason is because the first time you're watching it through, you know, it's one of the reasons you want to be able to watch it the first time again is you do have those suspenseful moments. And because you're hanging on the suspense, I mean, you really get caught up with the fact, is she going to get that turkey done and all that? So you get caught up with that and you miss a lot of the subtleties. And when you rewatch it, you pick up on those subtleties, and it just makes it a more complete picture or film when you do that. And so for the value of the subtleties, I think is completely worth the rewatch. And then, you know, I love it that you have us watch it at Thanksgiving. So.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and I want to echo, like, if your family doesn't have a Thanksgiving tradition and you want one, you should absolutely make watching Pieces of April every year on Thanksgiving a tradition.
I agree with you.
All right. So this, you got anything else?
I do have something else. I want to say that I am glad that you had me do this with you. And even though we won't be eating turkey together, at least we got to do this together. And
we've never once in my entire life eaten turkey together because, like April, I am a vegetarian, not a vegan.
Well, as I told my church Sunday, you are not really, you don't eat any vegetables, enough vegetables to be called a vegetarian.
Okay, roast me, Nancy. Just go ahead.
I told him that potatoes and cheese. So I said, put Terry in behind those and see what you come up with. But, you know, I can't be with you for Thanksgiving, but I am thankful to be able to do this with you. And so thank you for asking me.
Well, thank you for being on, Nancy. I'm thankful for you.
I'm thankful for you, boo. I love you.
I love you too. This has been Play It Again, Kyla. As always, if you have films you'd like to hear discussed, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find me personally at @Kyla_Z_Percival on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. And you can find the podcast at Play It Again, Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Once again, this is Play It Again, Kyla. I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off, saying happy Thanksgiving, and I voted for Andy Kaufman.